This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich.
Controversy continues to swirl around Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's call to ban Muslims from entering the United States in the wake of the violence in Paris and in Southern California. Some GOP leaders, such as House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, have condemned Trump's idea. But Ryan and others have stopped short of saying the comments should disqualify Trump from holding the highest office in the country.
But if you think Donald Trump's proposal is an outlier when it comes to how Americans view immigration, Lake Effect foreign policy contributor Art Sear would have you look closer at our history, both recent and long ago. He's with us in the Lake Effect studio to help us consider that history now. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you so much, Mitch.
As a student of history, is it at all difficult for you to believe that we are having a conversation at this point in time about barring an entire group of people from the United States?
Yes, I can believe it's a conversation that we are having in this election season. It's a terrible idea, obviously. On Tuesday morning on the talk shows, where Mr. Trump seems to constantly make the rounds, he said that Franklin Roosevelt did something similar in the interning of Japanese on the West Coast in the U.S., and there was also some limited interning and surveillance of German and Italian visitors to this country during that terrible time, much more terrible than today, let me emphasize. Actually, Roosevelt did not want to intern the Japanese. He was against it. It was contrary to his whole wartime theme of national unity and allied cooperation, which was a vital theme then, and it is now. Earl Warren, the Attorney General of California, a name that resonates because Eisenhower named him quite wisely Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the politically ambitious Mr. Warren, progressive Republican but a Republican, pushed for this. Roosevelt wasn't happy about it. He certainly wasn't happy about being outflanked on the right by an ambitious Republican. J. Edgar Hoover, the very law-abiding, relatively new director of the FBI, let me emphasize, a man who was very conscious of the Constitution and the law, is the head of the first federal police agency. Hoover was strenuously against it, but Roosevelt reluctantly went along with it. This is a pretty lengthy answer, even for me, but it's important because history is so readily distorted, especially by ambitious demagogues today.
Well, and it strikes me people are having this conversation about the internment of Japanese Americans and the legacy of those camps as though it's a positive legacy.
Yeah, actually, many years later, our government issued a formal apology. It was a bipartisan move in Congress, let me emphasize, and Japanese Americans who were interned were compensated. Despite this terrible behavior on the part of our federal government, understandable in the context of total war, Japanese Americans, as many of our listeners will know, Japanese American men served with great distinction in the European theater and were highly decorated in combat during that war, underscoring the importance of Roosevelt's policy of emphasis on unity. In war especially, you win when you emphasize as wide a coalition as possible. That was Lincoln's great insight, our founders for that matter during the Revolution. Certainly FDR deserves credit.
Well, and so the other historical comparison that some are making to what Donald Trump is calling for at this point goes all the way back to, I think it was the 1880s, and President Chester Arthur and his policy towards Chinese.
Great hostility to foreigners, very low paid, very hardworking. Chinese immigrants were vital in building the Transcontinental Railroad, especially the extremely difficult Western branch started by Abraham Lincoln during our Civil War, speaking of comprehensive leadership. After the Civil War, we opened the doors to immigrants from Europe, motivated, inspired mainly, I think, by the tremendous contribution German steel workers made, iron workers made during the Civil War in the Union Army. They were not only skillful at building artillery, but also at manning these guns during the fierce combat. Then we closed the doors. In 1924, we slammed the doors shut against immigrants during a very xenophobic time after the First World War and during the rise of communism. In 1965, we opened the doors. again, it's cyclical. That's an important insight. But the long-term trend has been toward tolerance and been toward opening the door more.
So has our attitude towards immigration always had some kind of hierarchy of the maybe a perceived economic contribution, you know, with the welcoming of highly skilled craftsmen versus, you know, sort of lesser skilled laborers?
I think people from literally all over the world are capable of working hard, contributing effectively, and contributing to the economy. The tremendous positive explosion of industrial capitalism after the Civil War was extremely important in making us more liberal. I teach political economy at Carthage College, and as I struggle to learn more about economics, one thing that strikes me more and more is just how important the marketplace is as an equalizer. In my lifetime and in your lifetime, the old Northeastern establishment, Northern Europeans, Anglo-Americans, dominated by our British traditions and cultures, they really ran foreign policy during World War II and during World War I and during most of the Cold War, at least until Vietnam. Overall, they did an extremely good job. I think it's right that we're more diverse in that leadership, and that profound change reflects much more diversity in our country. Tom Clawson, our graduate, for whom our Clawson Center is named, like to say that our strength is our diversity. Tom liked to speak in very blunt, direct statements many times. That was my favorite of his very blunt statements, and I think in many ways the most perceptive. Not an original statement. I don't think I ever told Mr. Clawson that, but an extremely important one. The more you learn about our wars as well as our remarkable long-term economic growth, the more you appreciate the importance of diversity in ethnicity, race, gender, across the board.
Is there a parallel to be drawn between, say, Donald Trump's rhetoric and the rise of the hard right in Europe?
No. I think he's much cruder and more primitive in some ways, ironically, than the Europeans. They tend to think more in ideological and class terms, including especially extremist leaders. I do believe that's true across the board, even in Britain, certainly on the continent. I do believe Mr. Trump is making it up as he goes along. Pure opportunist.
Do you see an effective difference in the kind of rhetorical, idealized place that Donald Trump and some of the far-right leaders in Europe are calling for and what ISIS is calling for?
Oh, yes, there's a lot, I think, in fairness to even demagogues. We have a tradition of very strong populism in this country. We are a society based on law. These people are guilty of promoting very bad ideas and in some cases bad conduct, but they can't rightly be called terrorists.
Well, and so speaking of ISIS, President Obama over the past weekend gave an internationally or nationally televised address, if it's fair to call it that. And in fact, is it fair to describe anything as a nationally televised address anymore?
Well, the president used to get all the airtime in an earlier age with more respect for authority generally, I believe. And what's striking to me is not too long ago, ABC, NBC, CBS, public broadcasting would stop all programming to give airtime to the president, a trend not directly related to our current president. That doesn't happen anymore. I had to do a little looking before I could finally find the president's address.
Well, and so what do you think is lost when the president no longer garners automatic national airtime?
It makes it harder to be president, I think, among other things. I think it reflects the fact that despite 9/11 and our current serious struggle against radical Islam and Islamic terrorism, a lot of Americans really don't want to be bothered. Reality TV, current sports game, and NFL, that's really more important.
So let's talk specifically about what the president said and the policy currently being carried out in regard to ISIS. What's working, what's not, and what don't we really know about at this point?
With no disrespect at all to the office of the president or the president, I think it was extremely unwise for him to seize upon, following the media, him to seize upon a very brutal and bloody and shocking crime, but a local crime in Southern California, and turn that into a major federal as well as national and international event. He thereby provided ISIS an opportunity to take credit for this crime. Current evidence is there's no serious evidence that this was part of a direct terrorist conspiracy, in great contrast to 9/11 and other events. ISIS immediately took credit for it. I think it was a very serious misstep. Again, no disrespect is intended, but it's an extremely important point, I believe, because the stakes are very high and in some ways getting higher.
Well, and so what reward does ISIS reap for getting to claim undue credit?
I believe it feeds their morale as well as giving them undeserved credit. It also, I choose my words carefully, it also diminishes the importance and therefore the influence of the office of the president. President Obama has been doing this from very early in his tenure, the famous Beer Summit. A rather difficult Harvard professor who refused to identify himself had an encounter with a Cambridge, Massachusetts police officer. These things happen a lot. The president of the United States interjected himself. It's very hard to be president. It's an office with tremendous demands, and you really should be focusing on your main responsibilities and be very limited in this kind of what I would call a PR stunt.
Is this a case of presidential micromanaging?
No, not so much micromanaging as going off in the wrong direction, I believe, compared to what has to be the focus in that central office. The Oval Office is used for major policy addresses and should be. There is a gold standard. These addresses are generally available on YouTube in our wonderful time. Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address, his speech to the nation when he sent the 101st Airborne Division, quite rightly, to enforce desegregation in Little Rock. George H.W. Bush during the Rodney King riots, those were a national event. John Kennedy announcing the beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis, in effect, and also a great change in his approach to civil rights legislation. Those are Oval Office addresses that were appropriate.
Would you have said there was some role for the president to have played in the wake of the Southern California tragedy?
Not publicly. I think we also spend entirely too much time announcing our latest military moves, sending special forces into the Syria region. Good idea, I think. Don't announce these things publicly. An awful lot should be going on privately. I'm sure it is. I think the current administration should be much more restrained in what they do publicly, what they say publicly.
Art Zier, thank you so much for speaking publicly.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Lake Effect contributor Art Zier is a professor of political economy and world business, and he's the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha.